Hey, I'm Johnny Mack with your daily comedy news. Did I ever mention that I like to run? Yeah, humble brag, I completed the 2013 New York City Marathon. And yeah, I'm going to tell you about it. You run 26.2 miles. You get to brag about it. Humble brag. Kevin Hart is also a runner. He says, it has become my space of meditation. I love running, or I've grown to love it, I should say, over the years. It's not something I started out having a passion for, but as I got a better understanding for it and found a calm within it, it became a go-to for me to be able to step away, put myself in a space where it's simply me against me, and I could talk to myself. I could think for myself and about myself and just find clarity within it. It became my space of meditation, for lack of a better word. I hear you, Kevin Hart. One thing that I quickly came to love about organized races, there's something very primal about it, just a bunch of humans all running off in the same direction. And you quickly learn you have to let your ego go. There's a 7-year-old kid who's going to dust you. There's a 91-year-old woman who's going to dust you. You just have to run your own time, run your own race, pace yourself. Don't worry about anybody else. The great thing about running is it's not like competitive, like, oh, my time was this, my time was that. If you say to somebody like, hey, I ran the whatever half marathon, they just go, cool. Nobody ever asked your time. You should get into it. It's great. Does Kevin Hart listen to music when he runs, or does he like to be alone with his thoughts? He says it depends on the mood and the setting of the morning. There are times when the feet on the pavement or the treadmill act as my music. There are times when I want something a little more soothing, maybe slow music, and times when I'm looking for a crazy amount of energy within the run. So there's hip hop. It's literally day dependent. Hip hop is what I like to run to. That and mashups. Like you take like a, I don't know, a Led Zeppelin song and you mash it with a hip hop song just to keep the brain going. I run to podcasts a lot as well. Kevin says, I think any time where I put myself in a space to be kind of by myself, that acts as my moment to gain clarity. So the gym is my sanctuary, and I normally have about a good 30 to 45 minutes of gym space all by myself before my trainer or friends or anybody gets there. That time when I'm stretching, that time when I'm warming up, it's normally just a time to relax, breathe, think about my day ahead, think about the week I have, think about goals, think about expectations, things I can improve on, things I can make sure that I'm aware of. It's just time to really think and be okay with my thoughts, good or bad. It's time to do that. Kevin spoke about having to confront issues or struggles head on rather than brushing them off or making light of them. And he said, that's my job. So regardless of the day that I'm having, that has nothing to do with people's expectations for me and what I choose to do as a career. I've learned to put all those things aside through the course of me doing my job. And once my job is over, I can sit down and deal with the problems that I may have. It's just understanding how to separate the two. And I think through the years, I've gotten a lot better at that and grabbed a much more effective way of solving that problem when it occurs. This next part I strongly agree with. Kevin said, I think that understanding the importance of taking care of your mental health, of working on your mental health, is something people should prioritize. In the pandemic, you got to see how real it is. You got to see how some people can truly struggle in this space, and it's not a joke. It's something that shouldn't be overlooked. I applaud those who have stepped up and voiced their problems and their struggles because it's given other people the courage to do the same. Totally switching gears. The AV Club has a list of TV characters that should be fired, and they want to fire the dean from Greendale Community College. What? The AV Club says TV is littered with well-meaning but incompetent education officials, but Community's Dean Craig Pelton stands apart for his combination of ineptitude and sociopathic behavior. It's not just that under his watch, Greendale Community College is constantly on the verge of closing down. It's also that he seemingly spends the majority of his time trying to ingratiate himself to the show's central study group at the expense of the rest of the student body. Furthermore, it's incredibly unlikely that Jeff Winger would not have sued the dean for harassment if for no other reason it might potentially accelerate his graduation, the concept of reality that was fluid within the world of Community. Brian Regan spoke to Vulture about the impact of social anxiety to his comedy. Brian said, I was a fan of Johnny Carson. To hear that he was really kind of awkward and quiet when he was out and about is interesting to many people, especially myself, where you go, the guy was in everybody's living room every night? How's that even possible? But I relate. Put it this way. I'm not the guy at the party with the lampshade on his head. I'm the guy on the other side of the room making fun of the guy with the lampshade on his head. When I'm on stage, it's not a conversation. I control everything. I control what I'm saying, when I'm saying it, how I'm saying it. I control the timing. I do everything. When you get me in a social situation, that can be so frustrating. I'm not always telling funny stories, but any story has timing and moments and beats, and it just kills me, the cacophonic aspect of life of people jumping in. You're at a party, you're telling a story, and somebody just comes in and goes, hey, Julie, and you're like, I was just about to say the important part. The social world is very challenging for me. It's like, get me back up on stage where I could say my story the way I want to say it. I like the observer part of comedy. It's like I'm observing things, and I'm noticing them, and I'm realizing what they do in my head. Sometimes they make me feel dumb. Sometimes they make me feel angry. Sometimes they make me feel this way or that way, and that's where the comedy comes from. When you go to a party, you can't just say, I'm here to be an observer. Can you put me in the corner so I can observe? You're kind of expected to mingle. When you're a comedian, a lot of people think, ah, it's going to be funny and entertain us. And it makes it even more challenging. I don't want to be around anybody who thinks I'm going to be the life of the party, you know? Keegan-Michael Key was excited to talk about the role of comedy in medieval times. This was part of his History of Sketch Comedy podcast. And he said, I used to work at Renaissance festivals. I thoroughly enjoyed working at the Renaissance Festival. The other thing is when you think about people like Trevor Noah and Stephen Colbert and Bill Maher and the comic pundits of our day, that's what jesters used to do in the court. They delivered news and current events within the court. There's something very akin to sketch in that. I was in a comedy show where we swung from rafters and people picked each other up over their heads and threw them into wells, saving the damsel and all that stuff. I did it for 2 years. And then another year, I was in a Commedia dell'arte group, which is Italian improvisational comedy from the 15th and 16th century. It was something I'd studied in school. I went around the festival in character and in my Commedia mask. I would try to stay in character the entire day in heels, by the way. I was 20, so I could handle it. One of his favorite sketches from Key and Peele was the Othello sketch. He said, I love at the end that we go find Shakespeare and try to shake him down. It was right up my alley because I got to write all the Elizabethan English for the dialogue. My favorite line in the whole sketch is when Jordan goes, more please, M-O-O-R. It's clearly two African-American gentlemen from the inner city going to the movies and then you slap on this Elizabethan veneer. It was one of my favorite sketches. Keegan also talked about Sid Caesar's Your Show of Shows, saying Sid Caesar created the template for what modern looks like. He changed the variety format. Variety came from vaudeville, so it was like, hey, there's going to be a juggling act, and then somebody on a tightrope, and then a comedian's going to tell some jokes. Sid Caesar decided, what if we just did the comedy? Keegan also likes the Muppets, saying, the thing that always resonated with me was the band. Animal the Drummer was my favorite. I didn't know I was watching a variety show. It was an actual, legitimate variety show. It's got sketches. It's got musical acts. The great thing about the Muppets is because they were puppets, they could do things you've never seen in an actual variety show, like the guy with the boomerang fish. On his podcast, he tried to figure out how to work in the movie Airplane because it's not a sketch. And then he thought about it, saying there's so many bits in Airplane that you could watch independent of the movie and still get enjoyment from it. Another joke we use is joke bucket. Like, here's the joke bucket. It's an Airplane movie and you just throw as many jokes in it as you can. Keegan-Michael Key, a member of the Mac Pack and host of the History of Sketch Comedy on Audible. From Daily News Online, teaching stand-up comedy is no joke. There's a YouTube video of Lee Pierce, assistant professor of communication, performing a stand-up comedy routine involving a Roto-Rooter man and a kitty litter box. The piece is genuinely funny, but Pierce says the value lies not in the laugh it gets, but in how it transgresses the norms of feminine hospitality. It's that combination of comedy plus social commentary that she teaches students in her course, The Rhetoric of Stand-Up. Pierce says, stand-up comedy has long been a vibrant form of cultural criticism, uniquely capable of normalizing and disrupting social values, blah, blah, blah. The class combines rhetorical theory and criticism with advanced public speaking. Students examine comedic tests, create and perform their own material, and even rewrite other comedians' bad jokes. They watch a lot of stand-up comedy. Pierce is quick to admit the course could easily devolve into just laughing at YouTube clips. That's not the objective, nor is teaching students how to tell a joke. Though if a student learns to do that, Pierce is thrilled. This reminds me, when I was at Sirius, I remember wondering if Mel Karmazin knew what the guy in that office, meaning me, over there is doing. Because when Mel walked by, it looked like I was just surfing the internet watching funny YouTube videos. Because that's what I was doing. I was trying to find new comedians for us to play on the comedy channels. If you're new, I used to run the comedy properties at SiriusXM. And, you know, I'd be sitting there laughing my ass off. And here comes Mel Karmazin. He was the CEO of the company in a suit and a very famous businessman. And I'd be like, I wonder if he was wondering what the hell I'm doing all day. But I digress. The professor says there's so much comedy coming out. Some that's socially transgressive and edgy, but in a very cool, productive way. Some that tells the line and some that's just straight up crap. Amen on that last one. The students bring in more and more examples and we keep having our debates. Is the juice worth the squeeze? Vulture spoke to the late night writers and they were very frustrated during the Donald Trump era saying we tried to do silly non-Trump jokes. We rehearsed in front of a live audience, but when we were done with the Trump jokes, the energy just died. It was clear that for whatever reason, other stuff wasn't going to fly, so most of the monologue ended up being 90% Trump. It's like an addiction. That's all people wanted. It felt like Trump was steering the ship. It wasn't like we weren't conscious of that after a while. But we were like, we're not going to mention Trump unless we have to mention Trump. But it's kind of crazy. Let's just say there's some story about a panda rescuing someone or something. It's so easy to make a Trump joke about that because from the audience's point of view, it's so unexpected. So it's very easy for even non-Trump stories to have a Trump punchline because it's kind of the shorthand. Then it becomes like, ah, this is just like the Trump show. It's frustrating because, you know, the one thing Trump wants more than anything is attention. It's the narcissist's dream to have everyone thinking and talking about them constantly, and he manipulated us into doing that. We rewarded his abuse by giving him exactly what he wanted. It stopped being fun really quickly. It's like drinking poison. How much poison can I make myself drink today? Maybe I can filter out some of the poison. They can hear the news through this comedic perspective, but after a while, you get tired of drinking poison every day. I think that's why a lot of people start out late night and then very wisely move on to other things. They get to running a sitcom or something like that. I don't have the gene for that, so I'm probably just going to keep poisoning myself until I drop dead or until I age out of employability. And that is your comedy news for today. Follow the show on Spotify or Apple Podcasts. If you like what I do and you'd like to support the show, you can donate $5 at buymeacoffee.com/dailycomedynews. I'll buy one of these. This is a large ice with caramel and milk. And I'll see you tomorrow.